In the 1986 thriller The Fly, Seth Brundle thought his body sores and decaying extremities were the result of a rare form of cancer, until he realized that he was turning into a fly. The man who turned Seth Brundle from a man into a fly is my guest today, special effects director Chris Whalis. In the sequel, Fly 2, Whalis makes his debut as a director. His company, Chris Whalis Inc., designed the special effects. Whalis is responsible for the special effects in many memorable scenes in recent films. In Raiders of the Lost Ark, he made a Nazi's face melt. In Scanners, he created an exploding head. And in Gremlins, he got those furry, nasty creatures to breakdance. Fly 2 picks up where the fly left off. The human fly is dead, but his genes live on in the fetus of his pregnant lover. The Fly 2 begins in the delivery room. I asked Chris Whalis how he came to direct The Fly 2.
It actually wasn't even my choice, and I didn't even know about it till it was almost happening. Stuart Kornfeld, who produced the first Fly, and I got along very well, and he was very sympathetic to my desires to direct. And when Fly 2 came up, they contacted him to produce and asked him who he wanted to work with as a director, and he said, me. And I think they sort of laughed the first couple of times, but he was very insistent and convinced Mel Brooks that it was a good idea, and the two of them sort of teamed up and battled the studio until everybody saw eye to eye that I was the choice.
Mel Brooks was the executive producer.
Executive producer. It was a Brooks film, yes.
Now, did you want to direct?
Absolutely. It's actually what I've always wanted to do since I was about 10 years old and found out that there actually was somebody sort of responsible for making those monster movies.
So did you work on special effects on Fly 2 since you were directing it?
I didn't work so much on effects, really. I tried to stand back as much as I possibly could. Of course, initially, it was very easy and, I think, wise for me to just go into my effects company and say, listen, this is what it should be like, and we should make one of these puppets and one of these puppets, and this should be done, you know, mechanically. Gave them sort of groundwork of specifics and then stepped out of the effects end of it and just sort of glanced at what they were doing every once in a while. And, you know, it was quite tough sort of keeping my fists in my pockets, not being able to grab onto everything.
And working with the human beings instead of the monsters.
Yeah, you know, it was very difficult for me to function without a lump of clay in my hand. So I have to admit there were a couple of times I failed on the set where I fell back into my old ways and had to paint the blood on or, you know, position the puppet or something.
Well, as a director, you had to come up with a different answer to the question that Fly 1 posed, which was, what would it look like if the genes of a person were crossed with the genes of a fly? Would you describe something of the solution you came up with for the second movie?
Sure. Basically, the premise of the first film was that it was a mistake. It was a biological imbalance. The genes were battling and fighting for control, and neither one was really winning. So it was a very asymmetrical, imbalanced, twisted, and wrong, non-viable creature that was forming. In Fly 2, we have a creature that is born intact, genetically balanced, and with a very solid biological destination. So, you know, in the design sense, it had to be much more purposeful, much more balanced, and much more of a hint of things to come than in the first film. In the first film, it was a disease, and you didn't really know where it was going. In our film, it really, you know, it's where it's going. I mean, you know from the title Fly 2, a guy's going to turn into a fly. So it was a matter of making sure that it did it nice and clean, nice and sharp, and very directed, so the audience could pay attention to the rest of the stuff that was happening in the film.
Do you want to describe the final monster that it turns into?
Sure. I wanted to have something that was a little spectacular. So we've got a nice big tall guy who's got four arms and two legs. Very colorful. I went with some nice fly blues and greens, and it pays, I think, a much more attention to an insect sort of crustacean orientation than the first film. But still, it was very critical that it have enough of a character to its face to be still relatable as the character. So it's still got, you know, two sets of eyes that turn and look and everything else, and, you know, the mouth is very different, but still relatable. The proportions of the face are close to human. but pretty different.
Did you study insects before either movie?
Yes and no. In the wider sense, yes, I did, because I've also always been a real nature fan. Since I was a little kid, I was the guy who was always, when everybody else was out on the street playing football or baseball, I was out in the vacant lot turning over old lumber and stones to see what was under them. So I had a real good working knowledge of entomology and, you know, like I say, I'm an amateur naturalist, so I got a good background.
I read that you also have studied mythology and fairy tales, and I bet that there's a lot of interesting ideas about transformation to get from those stories.
Oh, absolutely. It's, in fact, that's what a lot of this film is about. It's our character is, and I think it's one of the great things about the genre, science fiction, horror, and fantasy, are like really the few areas that are left in filmmaking where you can sort of go overboard and speak in much broader, larger-than-life terms and still get away with it. And in our film, it's really a story of a person who is born and seems to have absolutely no control over his existence, isn't happy with it, but is incapable of changing it. And it's only through a horribly painful experience that he has a rebirth and has the wherewithal and capabilities to actually take control of his life, which he does in a very twisted, unique way, I think.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Chris Whalis, and he directed the new movie Fly 2. It's a sequel to The Fly, for which Chris Whalis did the special effects. His company did the special effects for the sequel. There's a scene in this movie, and I don't think I'll be giving much away to tell this, where there's a man who's squashed by an elevator. Now, the kid in back of me, when that happened, said, yeah, two thumbs up, which I thought was a really odd reaction to have. And, of course, I wondered what Siskel and Ebert would have thought of it. But I was wondering if you ever go to movie theaters to just watch how people of different ages respond to the gorier special effects.
Yeah, it's really very interesting because adults seem much, much less tolerant of it than young people do. And I think that's a matter of the fact that young people don't have as great a sense of their own mortality and the realities of what that grossness is. And adults, you know, accept it on another more conscious level. And the kids are just there to see how far it's all going to go.
Do you want people to see your special effects and think, ooh, gross? Or would you prefer that they go home at night and have nightmares and really be haunted by the images that you've created?
Well, I actually hope it's a little bit of both, because I think I've struck a balance in the film where there are those moments that just hit the audience, and those are the sort of shock effect, gross out moments. And I think they're kept to a minimum. That same the head squash, as you describe it, is only 16 frames long. It's less than two-thirds of a second. It's not something where we paint the screen red from scene one to the end of the film. There are, I think, much more haunting images in the film of the boy who's got to put his dog to death, and the sort of tender moments between what is a human being and what was a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to think that the audience can go home kind of going, God, did you see that guy's head broken? It was disgusting. It was really weird. But you know what really got me was when I had to, I actually cried when the guy had to do the deed to his dog. You know, I'm really hoping to it'll hit people on a couple of different levels.
Do you ever edit out things because they're too gruesome?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when you're filming something, it's always wisest to shoot it as extreme as you can possibly do it. You know, just go way over the top, because then at least you have the choice of cutting back or showing the whole thing. And in fact, we cut out a part of the head crush was a little bit longer and actually much more graphic. I mean, if I can speak in very blatant terms, you started seeing what was inside that head a little more clearly. And that wasn't the effect that I was going for. It wasn't that extreme gross out. It was just a shock cut. So I cut that back, actually, to about a third the length of the shot.
How would that affect the ratings? Are ratings affected by gruesome imagery?
You know, it's very interesting, because this head crush is going to be the topic of conversation, I think, for a while. Because what actually happened was that was the shot that initially gave us an X rating with the ratings board.
Oh.
And I, you know, I went to him and I said, listen, you know, we've got a guy whose face is melting in five different cuts and it's over, you know, 20 times the length of this head crush. And their problem with the head crush was that it was more of an industrial accident than it was a, you know, a monster on the loose action. And I found that very disturbing because I think the monster on the loose stuff is actually much more vicious and absolutely more graphic. And so what we actually did, we extended the scene before the shot rather than cut the shot tighter. And what we did was we added two more shots of looking up at the elevator coming down, looking at the guy stuck at the bottom. And that just sort of prepared the audience for the shock of it, and they kind of went, "Yeah, that's great. That's all we wanted."
So the ratings board is sometimes more concerned with very realistic violence than with things they might consider more either cartoonish or fantasy.
Absolutely, it wasn't a matter of how much blood we put on screen. It was a matter of really how well we did it, and their sort of conviction was we sort of did that one a little too mm-hmm. good.
You know, I'm thinking back to early war movies. By early, I even mean, you know, in the 1950s, and you'd see somebody getting slaughtered, and there'd be no blood. And that there was a time when blood coming out of a wound was really a taboo on screen. That's certainly no longer the case. But I think there still are taboos on screen.
Well, I think it's you bring up an interesting point because in the old black and white days, actually in the earlier days, you will see blood on screen, and you will see some pretty graphic and strong stuff happening. And it was the introduction of color when suddenly blood being red leapt off the screen a little bit stronger than anything else that the true impact started hitting people, and they really tailored back, and they cut back, and as you say, they didn't show anything. You know, cowboys were blasting each other to shreds, and maybe there was a drop of blood coming out of their mouth, and that was it. And, you know, it was only sort of the new freedom of the 60s that allowed people to start pushing it again, and obviously I think it swung a little too far in one way, but it's coming back to more to storytelling. But it is interesting that there's definitely things that go too far, and I think in terms of the ratings board, it's not a matter of specifics all the time either. There are things that are just cumulatively distasteful and don't really, you know, it comes down to that question, what is the redeeming quality about it?
Mm-hmm.
And if there isn't some higher storytelling level, or there isn't some good point about it, then it is just wanton bloodshed for no reason. And I think that's what the ratings board and audiences really do object to.
Have you ever used any of your special effects wizardry to play a practical joke on somebody?
Never.
It could be a really horrible practical joke, given the skills that you have.
Yeah, I have to say it's sort of a standard thing that the special effects guys are always responsible for the craziest practical jokes. And we've certainly pulled a few in our time. But, you know, there's always the gags of sticking, liquid smoke in people's windshield wipers. And, there's all sorts of exploding things all the time. People having their birthday cakes explode and everything else. But in terms of getting really, pushing the joke of it. I'm very leery of that because a lot of people can take it the wrong way very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend not to be one of those guys.
Let's talk about some of the scenes that you've done for movies over the years and how you did them. I think one very memorable image that I'm sure most of our audience has seen was in Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Nazi whose face melts.
Right. That was one of the most difficult jobs I ever had to do, as a matter of fact. It was something that came as a surprise to me. I was working at Lucasfilm on another project, and Raiders sort of came in, and George originally was just going to blow up everybody's head at the end, and I kind of said, can't you do something a little more interesting and have some fun? And he said, sure, whatever. So we came up with melting this guy's head, which, you know, at first sounded like a great idea, and then when I sat down and thought about it and the restrictions that George had, he had just a few seconds to do this in. And it's very difficult to find things that are going to melt that quickly and controllably. So what happened was I wound up having to construct a plaster underskull, actually a stone underskull, and formulate a gelatin, almost a household gelatin, in separate layers and different colors, and put in all sorts of yarn and string and rubber bits and eyeballs and hair and everything else on a very, very delicate piece of work to get in front of the camera. And so that as it melted, it would obviously not just turn red and stop. I needed something that was going to keep the audience engaged a little bit more. So it goes through a lot of colors and everything else. And what happened was we basically stuck it in front of the camera. We shot it with a little bit of time lapse. I can't remember what the exact speed was, but the whole melting took about 10 minutes, and we got it down to about, I don't know, a couple of seconds actually. And I had two big air heaters, basically giant flames with fans behind them, blowing on this thing, melting it in front of the camera, and I was about 2 inches out of frame underneath with a hairdryer, you know, making sure it melted evenly and everything balanced out. And I had to mechanize things like the glasses and the eyeballs and things like that so that I could control them moving slowly so that they didn't pop all over the frame.
And you were lucky enough to get this on the first take, I hope?
On the first take, yes, but that's also given the fact that we did about 20 tests ahead of time to make sure we had our timing down and all the colors right.
Now, in The Fly, in the first version of The Fly, there's a very disturbing scene where Jeff Goldblum, as The Fly, is showing his girlfriend, played by Gina Davis, what's become of him, and he takes a donut, and he throws up on the donut to... because it's this enzyme that flies use to predigest their food. And then he scratches his ear, and his ear falls off.
Right.
And it's really very, very, very disturbing. Were you responsible for those effects?
Yeah. Of course, it was a massive effort, and a lot of people worked on it. And Stéphane Dupuis was sort of my head makeup man, was really the one who finally engineered that. And that it was pretty tough because we had to sort of really tape Jeff Goldblum's ears back pretty tightly and then put on a sort of a false wig, a false ear, and get some little tubes in there so little bits of goo dripped out. And there was just a little string that at the right moment got pulled and the ear fell off.
Actors must really dislike the hours and hours that they have to spend having the special effects makeup applied.
It really depends on the actor. It's usually the case that actors just don't want to deal with it. I mean, actors are very justifiably concerned about their face, their looks, being presented in the right aspect. So when we go to them and say, we're going to make a horrible monster out of you, they usually go, does it have to be a horrible monster? Can it be a good-looking monster? And then there are people who are like Jeff Goldblum, who was an ideal subject for special effects makeup. He was somebody who wanted the makeup. He wanted to be able to use that to let himself go with the character, and he used the prep time, the hours of makeup beforehand, to really get himself in character and to watch the process. He would open his eyes and look in the mirror as the pieces were going on his face, and you could just see how he was visualizing in his mind his own degeneration. And
so he was thinking of this as actually happening to him.
Yeah. And he used it as a great acting tool. Uh-huh. And he was, you know, beyond all that, he was incredibly tolerant and patient with it.
What got you so interested in doing special effects? Did you watch a lot of monster movies, horror movies as a kid?
That's really what did it. I started out as a real monster fan. I loved all the old Universal Pictures, all the old Silence and Godzilla and King Kong. And I really thrived on the old Ray Harryhausen movies, Sinbad and everything else. And obviously, as a little kid, wanted to relive those moments as much as possible. I didn't have a camera to make my own films, but I did have a bunch of clay to sort of make my own characters. So I literally used to sculpt up the monsters and the heroes and have little fights with each other. And it all sort of stemmed from there. And as it grew, I started doing makeup a little bit, very, very poorly, in the neighborhood.
Who would you make up?
I was the only one for a long time that I could find that would sit still. So I wound up making myself up most of the time, and it was always horrible mutants and hunchbacks and all sorts of Scarface things. And my mother got used to it pretty quickly. There were one or two times when I came barreling down the stairs with a bloody, torn-open leg that I think I got her. But most of the time, she was pretty immune to it.
Do you have any favorite images that really stuck with you from monster movies?
Oh, I think one image that I keep with me is from King Kong. And it's not actually an image of Kong or one of the monsters itself. It's Skull Island when they first get there. And I think it's something that epitomizes what the genre is about. It's just a shot of the characters looking over the boat at this very, very mysterious island, dark and hazy. And it always sold me on the fact that, yes, there is another world, whether it's all imagination or real or whatever. It's a very different, very strange place where anything can happen. And it really sort of acted as a great doorway.
How did you break into doing special effects for movies?
It was interesting. Well, I always thought it was interesting. Anyway, I was going to school at L.A. City College to pick up a couple of filmmaking classes. And surprisingly enough, I, as a starving student, ran completely out of money and had to take a job. I took a job at a Halloween mask-making company where I learned how to paint and a little bit of sculpting and molding and some of the very, very basics of this kind of stuff. And that company occasionally worked on like a TV commercial, a TV show, something like that. And I worked my way into their lab, and that's where you got to do that stuff. So I started there, worked on a couple of pictures, and then one day a guy named John Berg came in, and he was doing the special effects on a Joe Dante picture called Piranha. And, you know, he was just looking around to see what the facilities were, if it would be wise to try and make the rubber fish there, which it wasn't. But he did say, well, you want to work on a movie, kid? And I was like, you know, big-eyed, you know, stars in my eyes, kid going, oh, yes, I'd love to do that. And that was my introduction. That was my first real on-set experience of incredible underwater, arduous workouts and long, long days at New World Pictures. But it was a great experience and a great introduction to film.
Do you have a favorite outtake from any of the monster-type shots that you've worked on?
Oh, that's a good question. That is a good question. I think there were probably about 18,000 of them from Gremlins. We shot a tremendous amount of footage, an awful lot of gags, and we did a ton of stuff in the tavern sequence that's not in there. And I don't know if there's any favorites, but there's a lot of Gremlins flying through the air and smashing into walls that I remember fondly.
Mm-hmm. Have you like shopped butcher shops for blood and guts for movies?
I have to say I've never done that. I'm one of those people who's a little too squeamish to handle that.
Oh, come on.
Oh yeah, it's definitely the case. I you know, it's one thing, and
you can dish it out, but you can't take it, huh?
Yeah, you said it, and it's really interesting because I can pour as much blood on the screen as the next guy. And I watch the films that I've done it in, and I'm immune to it. But I watch somebody else's film, and I'll tell you, that knife goes to the throat or the wrist, and I just can't look.
Without giving away too much about Fly 2, I can say with confidence that the way it ends, there could be another sequel.
I think you have every justification to say that with confidence. Yeah, it's a real strong possibility. The thing about Fly 2 was it opened not just a franchise on another, you know, Friday the 13th or Freddy or something, but it's a new premise for trying out a lot of different ideas and concepts. The teleportation aspect is just, it's almost limitless in its possibilities of what can be done with it. There, in Fly 2, early on, we went through 30 or 40 different premises that were all intriguing and you know, each one was completely different from the others. So my hope is there will be another Fly 3 and it will be completely different from Fly 1 and completely different from Fly 2.
Of all the images that you've made in your own movies, is there one that you find stays with you the most, that you find really gets to you?
I have to say it's probably the exploding head from Scanners.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, it was something that, it was much more than even I was expecting when we did it. We worked very hard on that one, and that head was a real pain, and we made it under very grueling conditions and stayed up for 3 days straight trying to get it prepped. And I actually had to leave the day we shot it. So I didn't actually see it get on film, and I didn't see it until I saw it in the film. And then it hit me so hard. I knew it was coming, and I knew it was going to be graphic, but boy, it hit hard.
In an earlier interview on the program, David Cronenberg described how the only way to get that head to explode was for someone to lie off camera with a rifle and shoot the model of the head.
Yeah, it was a shotgun with some very fine pellets in there. And what that actually did, this was the part that sort of surprised me more, was it didn't just spray the head all over the place. It sort of popped it and pushed it forward. So, you know, this stuff was forced directly to the camera. So it wound up, I think, being much more powerful than even David was expecting. And he loved it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about some of your movies. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.